This is a special CHOI report. National Day for Truth and Reconciliation will be marked across Canada today to remember the survivors of Canada's residential school system and the children who never made it home. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada concluded that residential schools were a systematic government-sponsored attempt to destroy Aboriginal cultures and languages and to assimilate Aboriginal peoples so they no longer existed as distinct peoples. The commission characterized this intent as cultural genocide. Vancouver Island University marked the day with an event at Malaspina Theatre where survivors of residential schools shared their stories with the audience. These stories include descriptions of violence, including sexual violence, against children, so I will pause to give you time to turn down your radio or put on a set of headphones. Uncle Randy Fred is an elder at Vancouver Island University who attended the Alberni Indian Residential School, which closed in
1973. Yeah, my name means no eyes because I'm totally blind. And my granddaughter, with her great sense of humor, gave me that name. And she's actually my Tsishat language teacher. She's 15. So it's really cool, you know, to see our culture coming back, you know, and the residential school had so much to do with attempting to destroy us as a people, as a culture. And my dad, when he first went to the Alberta Indian Residential School, they stuck a needle right through his tongue twice when he was caught speaking our language. And first of all, I want to acknowledge the fact that we are on the traditional territory of the Snanaymoch, and I'm very grateful for being allowed to be here. And, you know, the Alberni Indian Residential School was just over the mountain. And there were children sent there from way up Stewart, Prince Rupert, you know, all, you know, Tsimshian, Nishka, Kitsan, all the way down Haisla, Heltsuk, Bella Coola, all over Vancouver Island. 300 kids at a time in this horrible school. And the last place that we lived, like my father was a commercial fisherman, and we tended to always live by ourselves on an island. And it was convenient for him, you know, close to the fishing grounds. And we were 3 miles outside of Banfield at a place called Dodger's Cove. This beautiful spring day, there's a beautiful boat came into the harbor, a real shiny boat. These two guys got in a skiff and they came ashore, and my mother went down to greet them, and then I was hiding behind her, and one of them asked her, "How old's that boy there?" And she said, 5. And it was RCMP, and he told her, "We're coming back here in September, and if that boy is here, I'm sorry to tell you, but we'll have to haul you off to jail." And so I don't even know if that was a written law, but, you know, like I know, I've heard a lot of stories about people being threatened, you know, about being sent to jail if they didn't send their kids to the school. And when I started in 1956, there was, many of the roads weren't paved. And so, you know, they would have buses come all the way from Prince Rupert, take them 3 days. And, you know, I just can't imagine that trip, you know, being taken away from your parents and, you know, forced to go to a whole different territory and live in prison conditions. You know, an interesting thing is that I ran into several people who had been students at the Alberni Indian Residential School, and they had come out of jail, maximum security. And they said, "You know that Ocala prison, man, don't worry about ever going to jail because, man, you can do your time standing on your head in that place. It's so easy compared to the Alberni Indian Residential School." The churches signed contracts with the federal government to look after the schools for the government. And, you know, they weren't given a lot of money to look after us. And a lot of the staff were people who couldn't get work elsewhere. So there was people kicked out of the Navy and, you know, armed forces, people kicked out of the police forces and, you know, sadists, you know, people with, you know, this real control over us, like 24 hours a day. They could do whatever they wanted with us. There was no you know, there was, sure, there was a principal there, but he didn't really have any oversight of his staff. Like, you know, I remember very rarely seeing the principal, you know, where we slept, you know, the dormitories. You can imagine the abuses that they imposed on us, you know, as children. You know, they had total control of us, like I said, and, you know, they could do whatever they wanted with us, and there was, you know, no repercussions. And so, of course, there's a lot of sexual abuse and horrible, horrible stories. I was involved in the Blackwater case where we sued the United Church and the government of Canada for abuses imposed on us by the staff. And the stories that came out in court were so horrific, many of them unbelievable. The Blackwater case was a precedent-setting case, and it really set the stage, you know, for where we are today. You know, I tell people that it was an important milestone on the road leading to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And the court cases themselves have never really properly been documented, so I've taken it upon myself to produce a video. And this Saturday, we're going to start recording in Port Alberni. There's a celebration going on there to commemorate 50 years since the Alberni Indian Residential School was shut down. I was there for 9 years as a student, and then I was there when the West Coast District Council of Chiefs shut down the school. I was the accountant for them. And it was kind of strange, you know, like, you know, this big institution where, you know, I was treated like worse than an animal. We moved our offices in there. So that was really strange, you know, to be working. In fact, I think my office was the principal's office, I think. And like just to be there was really, really traumatic. Moving forward into the 1990s, there was five guys who had reported Arthur Henry Plint to the principal for the sexual abuse. And the five guys were punished. The principal punished them for reporting this guy Plint. You know, there were Willie Blackwater, Gilbert Johnson, his brother Rudy Johnson, and from here, Melvin Good and his brother Stan Good. They were, you know, they were the five heroes who launched the whole thing, you know, the cases. And an interesting thing was in court, all of us could remember the first day that we went to the school. You know, a good four-hour run in my dad's fishing boat from Dodgers Cove up to Port Alberni. You know, my dad had to rent two taxi cabs to get us all up to the school. And I just thought we were going there to say goodbye to my older brothers and sisters. But my dad picked me up, carried me up these front stairs and handed me off to this guy. And he brought me inside to the principal's office. And I was crying the whole time, you know, like no idea that I was going to be left there. And then this the principal handed me off to a supervisor who brought me up to a dorm five where the young boys slept. He had me undress and then go into a shower. And he had a canister with bug spray. And while I was showering, he sprayed me all over my body with that bug spray. And that was my welcome to the Alberni Indian Residential School. You know, despite, you know, the horrors that were imposed on us, you know, there were many good times. You know, like today, it's such an honor for me to cross paths with Fran Tate. You know, Fran Tate attended that school, her and her two brothers, Andrew and Melvin. And Fran was a real trailblazer in this institution here. You know, Malaspina College, she opened a lot of doors for Indigenous students, you know, to be able to attend, and she helped many students here for many years. And Andrew was a very good friend of mine in the Alberni Indian Residential School. He actually protected me, you know, because it was a prison environment. You know, the older boys many times would prey on the little boys. You know, I was sexually abused by many older boys. You know, and then you can imagine, you know, some of these guys were chiefs, you know, and, you know, having to work with them in that same building, you know, I used drugs to endure, a lot of drugs. And, you know, despite the horrific life in the Alberni Indian Residential School, you know, it's still possible to get through life. The celebration in Port Alberni, you know, 50 years since the school was shut down, there's I was thinking about the people that I started school with there in grade one, and, you know, the majority of them are gone, and the majority of them died from violent deaths. You know, that's one of the real impacts of the school was, I guess in a way, you know, the alcoholism, the drug addictions, you know, was, in my mind, in my case anyway, it was like suicide. Like I always had a death wish. I attempted suicide twice. You know, when I drank to the point of blacking out, for me it was like death, you know, because all of a sudden there was nothing. And then I would wake up and, whoa, where am I? You know, and so it was like this little escape, you know, and many people I know who were sexually abused, attempted suicide, and many of my family members, actually committed suicide. And I know for a fact that they were sexually abused. You know, the impacts for men being sexually abused are the same as women being raped. Difficulty touching people, you know, the suicidal tendencies, the alcoholism, drug addiction. You know, all these effects, you know, are so rampant among our people. And, you know, we're digging ourselves out of all that negativity, learning to live like healthy people and learning to be happy. When I started here a couple of years ago, like I made a decision that I want to be a happy elder. And I want to spread that happiness. You know, at times like this, you know, it's unfortunate that I have to share such a horrific story, but it's reality. You know, it's important for all of you to really understand where First Nations people are coming from. You know, colonization, you know, failed at destroying us. You know, all the attempts that were made to destroy us failed, and we're still here. I will leave it at that. Click go, click go.
That was Uncle Randy Fred, an elder at Vancouver Island University, who attended the Alberni Indian Residential School as a child. You are listening to a special report on National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. Please be advised that some stories in this broadcast include descriptions of violence, including sexual violence, against children at Canada's residential schools. Fran Tate is a former academic advisor at Malaspina College and a survivor of the Alberni Indian Residential School. She talked about her experience at the school at Vancouver Island University's Malaspina Theatre on Thursday.
My name is Lass, Tsimshian Nation, Lakhwalam's Band, House of Gitwal Gyats, the Skeeks Clan. My mother was Lorraine Ryan. My father is Andrew Tate. My maternal grandparents are Harrison Emma Ryan, Nee Knott. And my paternal grandparents were Lillian and John Tate. According to Ancestry, I have a little bit of Scottish and Irish in me. I don't know which part or how much, but it's there. If you don't know where Lakhwalams is, it's also known as Port Simpson. And it's 35 miles northeast of Prince Rupert. I had a younger sister. She was murdered. My father died of TB, and my mother was murdered. So we became orphans, we being my two brothers and I. And that's when Indian Affairs stepped in. So at the age of 5, I, along with my two brothers, were taken to Alberni Indian Residential School. And I stayed there till I was 18, or graduated from high school. In order to understand how life rolled on, I remember Randy from Alberni. He's just a young'un. My two brothers, imagine me with dark hair. Imagine me with, I think I was a little bit taller, and darker skin. My oldest brother and I had that in common. My other brother stood 6'1", had very, very, very fair complexion and ketchup red hair. So he stood out in a crowd and got picked on because he was different. When we were dropped off at the residential school, my first memory is seeing this big white man standing at the top of the stairs of the red brick building, black suit, white tie, a black white shirt, black tie, black patent leather shoes and white hair. His name was A.E. Caldwell. And alongside him were a number of supervisors, male, female. My brothers and I always were together before we were taken. We get to the front of that school, and that's when we were separated, never coming back together, ever. So from the age of 5 to 12 is when all the sexual abuse happened, the physical abuse happened, the beatings that you can't even imagine. And every year, they would gather us together in June and tell, read a list of names of who was going to go home. I waited. My name was never called. So one year I stole a suitcase, thinking that if I had a suitcase, I could go home. And then I realized, where's home? What is a home? I knew nothing. So from age 5 to 12, I spent 12 months a year When I was finally told I was going home, I was really excited, but I didn't know what for, because I didn't know where I was going, because all I knew was that I had two brothers. So we get on the bus and go to Prince Rupert, six buses. Now remember, everything, our whole life has been conditioned. Boys on one side, girls on the other, junior, intermediate, senior. We were never to mix. So the buses go to Prince Rupert. By the time we've gone from six buses down to two or three. And I remember stopping at the bus depot on 3rd Avenue and see this sea of faces of my people. Kids in the bus were happy, you know, screaming, calling out their families' names. My two brothers sat on either side of me and we didn't move because we didn't know anybody. Finally, everybody was off the bus. And then this lady gets on. She's got a winter coat on, a scarf around her head, and she's, I define it as cackling, laughing. And she stands at the front of the bus and she says, "Oh, there's the redhead, the boy and the girl. My family did not know me. My family did not know my name. I didn't know them. They were strangers to me. My aunt, that was my mother's older sister. We went on their fishing boat back to the village. The word spread around that Ween's children were home. That was my mom's nickname. And everybody gathered at the house, at my aunt and uncle's house, and the party began. And that night I was raped by four uncles. So my community was no safer than residential school. So it was probably at that point in my life I built this wall. You can't see it, but I know it's there. And I became a very angry, bitter person. And the odd thing is that when I was told that year, I spent the year in the village going to school. It was no different than residential school. And when they told me I was going back to Alberni, it was okay. It was a system I knew. I knew how to survive in that school. I knew where I fit in. I had some modicum of control. The man who abused me the most, he actually said to me, "I'm letting you go," like I was his property. And he said, "Because you're too young, you're too big, you're too fat, you're too ugly." And those six words meant my freedom. But it wasn't until years later I realized that it was also his license to go on to other five-year-olds, other six-year-olds, boys and girls. And the thing is this man was not a supervisor. He was the accountant. He was the financial person for the school, so he should not have had any contact with the children, but he did, and he was the worst. And the thing that also bothers me is that Saturday nights was movie night, and movie night was his favorite time to take the girls out of the auditorium to his bedroom, and he'd rape them, me included. And then Sunday morning, he would stand up in the pulpit and preach about sin. I often describe my relationship with my brothers as railroad tracks. They go on, they go on, they go on, they never meet. That's how my brothers and I were after being at that school. All three of us turned to alcohol, life of the party. I quit 27 years ago. And if any of you know my daughter, when she said to me, "If there's any grandchildren, you will not be seeing them if you keep drinking." That was a Thursday. Friday, I stopped. Grandchildren didn't come till later, but but here they are. And those grandchildren are my life. They are, I was going to say leaning post, but I'm their leaning post now because they're taller than I am. Oh, I think I broke Paige's hand. I worked for Malaspina University College, but I never worked for VIU. I just want to make that clear. That was supposed to be funny. There were a lot of firsts in my job here as an academic advisor. And it wasn't an easy journey. My learning curve was like this. Apparently, the Indian problem was my problem to solve. I didn't know what the Indian problem was. There was nobody I could lean on to say, how do I do this? Because there was nobody. I wasn't welcome at Malaspina. There was no need for a special position. Those Indian kids, they do their own thing, you know. So that was the mentality of the day. And I had to deal with white male faculty who saw my existence as worth nothing. And so that was who and what I had to fight. And it's hard to do that battle alone. So I had to rely on people in Snanemo, even though that was a battle as well. But I learned how to battle in this kind of environment because I'd already been trained in residential school. I just hadn't realized that I could take those skills and apply them here. But beating up people didn't solve my problems, so I had to learn other strategies. My bull in the china shop approach to problem solving doesn't work in this kind of environment. Maybe on a basketball court or a soccer field, yes, but not here. So I had to learn different ways to handle things. I still have my triggers. I still find it difficult to talk in front of people. But I know I have family out there, so De Lo Ande. And that's what I focus on. I think I'm sitting up right now. I will speak later. Thank you.
That was Fran Tate telling her story as a survivor of the Alberni Indian Residential School at Vancouver Island University's Malaspina Theater on Thursday. Dale Hunt is an educational advisor for services for Aboriginal students at Vancouver Island University. He spoke about growing up as a child of residential school survivors and how that intergenerational trauma affected him as he raises his own son.
A part of truth and reconciliation is telling the truth, and there is a lot of truth to some of our pasts. Having two parents that went to residential school, some of the things that I had to survive, I say that I survived the survivors. That's huge to be able to say you survived the survivors, but I can say barely, because when you witness some of the things that your parents had to go through, the hurt, the pain, and then how they choose to go move through that pain. I grew up in a household that had alcoholism, domestic violence, and all of the things associated with that type of environment. And I grew up an only child, even though I have six siblings. Very complicated, very confusing sort of upbringing. But I grew up as an only child with two parents who were survivors, and it was a party. They chose to deal with their pain through alcohol because it can be fun. There are certain things, you know, about that social aspect of alcohol that can be fun, but when you take it too far, that's the environment that I grew up in. They say that there's two things that you can do with it. You can say, I witnessed that and I don't want to be like that, so I'm going to do everything I can not to be that. Or there's the ones who are going to go, wow, that looks fun, and when I try it, woo-hoo, can I have fun with this? But not realizing and not having those parents that can teach you what it's like to have a healthy relationship with alcohol, to have a healthy relationship with community, to have healthy relationships in general. You grow up not realizing that that path can take you down a path of losing. And when I became a parent, I still didn't realize. Some of the things that I strive for are perfection. So my mom was always perfect. You had to be perfect. And if you weren't perfect, you were punished. So those are some of the things that I have to walk with in life. So I wanted to be the best goddamn father I could ever be. And I strive every single day to do that. But I struggle as a father. I don't know. I want to be perfect, but I don't have to be perfect anymore. So having children, now you know, you see a mother and parents that go through residential school. Now I'm a father and now I have children. So there's layers of emotions that go on when you're the child of a survivor. But I almost had to lose everything in order to gain everything back. I went down that path of alcoholism. I went down that path of addiction. And I pretended. I was a very good pretender. Not any one of you, some of you would know me, that I pretended to be perfect. I pretended to be okay. I pretended because I was too ashamed to say the history and the past.
Lillian Morden is the Director of Indigenous Education at Vancouver Island University. She spoke at the Orange Shirt Day event at Malaspina Theater about intergenerational trauma.
Those of you who are teachers in the room, or those of you who know a teacher in the room, know that teachers have to do all their prep ahead of time, right? We go back, we go over the lessons ahead of time. My daughter was 5, and I was preparing for the week in my coursework where I sat in circle with my learners in my class and talked about residential schools and reviewed material, watched videos with them, and I was watching a video late at night after the kids had gone to bed, just to make sure that it was fresh in my mind before I sat down the next day. And my 5-year-old daughter comes tromping down the stairs as they're talking about putting kids in cattle trucks and driving them away, and, "Mama, what is this?" I'm like, "Well, I guess if we're old enough to take kids when they're 5, we're old enough to tell them that they're not gonna get taken anymore." And so I sat with my daughter on my lap and explained, and she asked all the questions that she could and wanted to. And her big question was, "What the heck?" in a 5-year-old brain size. "Mom, are they gonna be able to do that? Can someone come and take me away? Like, is this gonna happen?" Because she heard them talking, the little pictures of the little people, and she's that age. I was like, "You know what, baby? They can't do that anymore. They're not gonna come and take you away from me." And then I realized that that's actually not true. It's not true. It's true in different ways. And I also know in my own behavior, I recognized that when she wanted the Dora the Explorer haircut and I almost fell over, because for her, it was the Dora the Explorer haircut and it was the cutest thing ever. For me, it was the haircut that they made my mom have when she went to residential school. And I had to bite my tongue, smile, and go, "Baby, you can have whatever hair you want," because that's the lesson that I need to take from that. Not the residential school haircut, but that my child can choose whatever haircut she wants, because my mom didn't get to. And so in everything, there's a learning and a way forward in this. If I'm gonna stay in the positive, because I have to. But as it stands, here I am, a little kid who used to run around in the mud, who worked all the way through university, part-time. And now I'm apparently a grown-up person, and I get to stand in front of all of you and be so proud that we're all here together, and that there's so many gatherings all over, and that we're gonna learn and figure this all out.
You have been listening to a recording of the Every Child Matters Orange Shirt Day ceremony at Vancouver Island University as part of CHOI's special programming for the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation. For CHOI News, this is Mick Sweetman.
This report was made with the support of the Local Journals Initiative, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and listeners like you.